Now we were speaking last time about Luther and some of the various details connected with the spread of the Reformation in Germany. I mentioned incidentally the Night Uprising. I did not give that a separate head, but we noticed that in those first couple of years that he was back at Wittenberg, that there was an uprising of the class known as the Knights, who were people who were fighters with good armor and horses, but usually not a great deal of property. They were looked on as a superior class to the peasants, but much inferior to the counts and the nobles. As a leader gathered them together to try to raise their status and their property, and he talked much about what Luther had written about the oppression by the church leaders, and he spoke also of the way that the emperor had acted toward Luther and tried to make it look as if what they were carrying on was the same thing as what Luther was standing for. But Luther very clearly dissociated himself from it. And the Knights, when they made their uprising, it was put down and they were completely defeated in their efforts. And it did make some people think the Reformation was failing because of the efforts of the Knights leaders to get people to think that their movement was a part of the Reformation movement. But a much greater threat than that came through the Peasants' War, capital G. And this is perhaps the one thing for which Luther has been more attacked in recent years, more criticized, is his relation to the Peasants' War. Those in particular who think that the purpose of the church is to do away with poverty and to build the kingdom of God on earth here have the attitude that Luther, of course, should have stepped in and become a great social leader of the peasants, and the fact that he did not do so, but that he took attitudes very different from that, has been used as an attack against Luther. But Luther's attitude, nobody is consistent in everything. It is impossible. Life is filled with threads that go in various directions, and we have to decide which are to us the most important and stand straight and consistently on those. And if we do, we will find that our relation to other threads varies from time to time. Luther was interested in the spread of the gospel, in the stand for the word of God, in standing for true righteousness and true justice as he found it in the word, and spoke out more than most leaders do, more than most people do. He spoke out, giving his mind on important matters as it appeared in the light of the information then available to him. And the result is that to those to whom other things are vital than the things that were vital to Luther, he appears very inconsistent. But even such a man as George Smith, in his Life of Luther, says that though many people thought Luther was inconsistent, he took a stand which was definitely in line with his great central purposes and which was necessary if the Reformation should continue. The one thing which perhaps all can agree that was not necessary was the extreme way in which he sometimes spoke. He sees an error here and he strikes out against it. He sees an error here and he strikes out against it. And you take the strong way he strikes about this and you think anything over there is all right. And then the strong way he strikes against that, you think anything over here is all right. He used very strong language in attacking what he thought was wrong. And that language by itself might lead you to think that he did not take an equally strong attitude against what he thought was wrong in various other directions. And so we find that the Peasants' War is a matter which is necessary that we know something about. Now, capital G is the Peasants' War, 1524 to 1525. I don't think I'll give you subheads under this G, but simply try to give you a general idea of what happened and what Luther's attitude was toward it. First, a general statement of what this was. It should be recognized that the Peasants' War, the uprising, was not something that was new or unique. The situation of Europe at the time was that technical development was very, very slight. Even in the Middle Ages, even the great feasts of the nobles would be thought hardly fit for the poorest people today. There just was not much produced, and there was not enough to go around to give a decent living, actually, to more than a fourth of the people. And so you might have perhaps 1% of the people who lived in what they thought was luxury, but which would hardly come up except in perhaps brilliance of style and decoration. It might be rather great, but otherwise it would hardly come up to the average of the lower middle class today, as far as the convenience and comfort of life is concerned. That would be the situation of perhaps 1% of the people. And the rest of the people were having to, most of them, to work 12 or 15 hours a day in order to get a very, very meager living. That was the situation. It just wasn't enough to divide up. What was needed was more production, was an improvement in the what was produced. To take what this 1% had that lived in what the others thought was great luxury and divide it up among the rest would not have raised their standard of living 1%. But naturally, it did arouse a certain amount of envy and of dislike on the parts of some. But the peasants, the great majority of the people who lived on the land and who worked as a terrific long hours to just grow enough to live on, and a certain small percentage of what they had was taken away to give the very tiny percentage of people who had anything a chance to have a certain amount of what they called luxury. This tiny bit yet was enough to make the peasants feel very unhappy. But it wasn't actually the tiny bit that was taken away from them, but the fact that the total production was not enough to give a decent living to anybody, that resulted from time to time in the development of tremendous dissatisfaction. And in just about every country of Europe, in just about every century during the later Middle Ages, there was a big revolt of the peasants, an uprising. Someone would come along who had brilliant ideas of how, if you see these people over there who are living in luxury, we just kill them and take what they have, and we'll live in luxury too. When actually, to divide it up among them would give them not 1% more than what they did have. But when people are in such misery, it is natural for them to easily get aroused and see what they think will improve their lot. And the result was that at least once a century, in most of the countries of Europe, there was a big peasant uprising. And usually these peasant uprisings were put down comparatively easily, but with a great deal of slaughter and a great deal of misery. And this had happened over and over through the Middle Ages. It happened so frequently that the history books say very little about it, except when it happened to come at a time when things were more or less in a state of flux. Like in England, just during the life of Wycliffe, there was a tremendous big peasant uprising. So there had been an equally big one a century before in England, an equally big one 2 centuries before. Now there had been these in various parts of Germany, but perhaps it was easier for the dissatisfaction and the idea that this sort of method could bring real improvement to spread in Germany at this time than earlier times, because printing had been invented. And they numbered by 1525, the number of books that were being printed in Europe was at least 4 times as much as it was, say, in 1510. And so there was a much wider dissemination of information and ideas, even though it was very small compared to what you find today everywhere. Of course, at this time, the scholars could all read Latin. Scholarly things were all written in Latin, and scholars were traveling a fair amount through Germany. But among the rest of the people, it was a bit easier for ideas to spread. And, of course, one thing that entered into it is that these prophets who had come into Wittenberg had become associated with a man who was like them, except that he spoke in much stronger language than most of them did. and who declared that the kingdom of heaven was about to come on earth. All that was necessary was that the peasants should kill off the lord and should take their property and should establish the kingdom of God on earth. And this man, who was a fiery preacher of revolution, was going about, and these men would quote from Luther's statements about everyone's duty to be kind to his neighbor and helpful and follow the gospel teaching. And they would quote these statements to them and then point out how, in general, the lords were not this way, and would urge revolt. And the result was that there developed at this time a revolt which, on account of the somewhat improved communication and somewhat more travel than there had been before, may have been somewhat larger than the ones of, say, a century or two centuries before, but not a great deal. And the revolt got perhaps a better start than it would have in previous years. Partly Luther is responsible for that, perhaps, because his teaching about the importance of being good and kind and helpful was read and greatly influenced many of the lords who a century before would have risen up in arms at the first sign of insurrection and put it down in bloody fashion, to say, well, these people have some proper reasons for complaint, and let's hope that their injustices can be remedied and that the thing will blow over. And so perhaps they didn't start quite as soon to stop it as they would have in ordinary times, and it got a bigger start. At any rate, there was, in the years 1524 to 1525, and in particular in 1525, there started in South Germany near the Swiss border a strong insurrection, a movement of the peasants, and they stormed certain castles and greatly humiliated and outraged the women in them, killed all the men, and then killed the women and burned them. And there were a considerable number of actions of this sort done. And the movement spread over a good part of Germany. And this one man, one of the prophets, though I'm not sure he had actually been in Wittenberg, but he was associated with these others who had been in Wittenberg, he exhorted the people to kill the oppressors. And he used fiery language. He was a very able speaker, and he aroused them to destroy and burn and put an end to this, and remember how your ancestors have suffered from these people. And he used very strong language, but once the lords were really stirred, they found it easy with the weapons they had at their hands and with the trained soldiery that they possessed. They found it easy to put down the revolt of the untrained peasants with very little equipment, and once they were put down, many of the lords were utterly ruthless and cruel in their slaughter of those who had been active in the revolt and in their treatment of those who had been associated with them, and so that actually, right after the peasant revolt, the lot of the peasants as a whole was much better than it had been before. Yes? This man's name was Thomas Münzer, capital M-U-N-T-Z-E-R. There's two little dots over the U. So the U is pronounced with, what they call a German umlaut, Münzer, M-U-N-T-Z-E-R. And I haven't asked you to remember his name, but we're interested in one who wants to share it. But this is the general course of the peasant revolt. Now, the Catholic Encyclopedia, there's a new Catholic Encyclopedia in the last year or two, but the big Catholic Encyclopedia that was published more than 60 years ago, I remember when I was in college, I read the article on Luther, and it stressed, it said that while the peasant revolt was in full swing in South Germany and people were dying, Luther callously married and gave himself up to the joys of connubial bliss. Well, that's the sort of way you can attack individuals if you're just determined to attack them. But
It's mostly the attack on him sexually has come from other directions than that. It's been related more to the things he said. But before we mention what he said, let's just briefly mention the relation of it to two of the leaders of the nobles who were connected with the Reformation. One of these was young Philip of Hesse. You remember, Philip of Hesse is a young man, just over 20, who had just succeeded to his father's estate. His father had been dead some time, but he had reached his majority and had become full ruler of Hesse. He was at the Diet of Worms, and there he saw Luther and was convinced that Luther's ideas were right and determined to do everything he could to forward them in the area over which he was ruler. Well, Philip of Hesse had been ruler over Hesse for 2 or 3 years by this time, and during that time he had been doing his best in his relation with his subject to carry out the teachings of the Bible as he read it and as Luther presented it. And the result was that when the uprising of the peasants, which was becoming so widespread all through Germany, resulted in an uprising in Philip's territory, he went out and met with the leaders of the peasants in his territory, talked with them, got them to describe to him in full their grievances, was able to convince them that certain of the grievances were things in the general condition that there was nothing could be done about, and that if they simply killed him and took his property, divided among them, it would be practically nothing, but recognized that they had certain real grievances, certain real injustices, which were widespread, and agreed to remedy those. And was glad, in fact, to have his attention called to them and did remedy them. And so the uprising in his territory amounted to practically nothing. Now, Frederick, the other man whom we should mention in this connection is Frederick the Wise. And Frederick the Wise was quite an elderly man now. He was bedridden at this time, and he heard the stories of the peasants uprising all around and heard about rumblings in his own territory. And he was on his deathbed, and he said, well, maybe things are going to be completely changed. Maybe the common man is going to take over, and the nobles are to lose all their power. There was really nothing he could do about it. But actually, his rule had been so much more beneficent than that of the rulers in most of Germany that there was not much of an uprising in his territory. Those who were strong, felt strongly with the peasants in his territory, mostly moved, went and joined groups in other areas. And Frederick, though, died right in the middle of the peasant uprising and was succeeded by his brother John. And John, Frederick, never publicly declared himself a follower of Luther. He, during the 8 years since the Reformation began, he had taken the position of the impartial lord of this area, trying to maintain justice and right, and determined that his professor in his university would not be unfairly just, but wrongly treated. And though he read Luther's works, and Luther wrote special discussions of the Bible to comfort him in his illness and so on, and doubtless in his heart he was a real follower of Luther, or became such in the course of these years, he never made any such public declaration. But his brother had been for some time an outspoken supporter of Luther. And so now the Elector of Saxony was a man who declared himself to be a supporter of Luther. John, the new Elector of Saxony, a man of high character, a very fine Christian man, but not nearly as able as old Frederick in the cause of the Reformation. Yes? John. J-O-H-N. Yeah. Yeah. And you never know with these foreign names whether they're going to be spelled like they do in English or not. Of course, they actually spell it J-O-H-A-N-N. But we are anglicizing some of these names because we've been customary. Now, the so much for first the general course of the peasants' war and its complete failure, complete end, and the for its relation to the
two men who were outstanding in their support of the Reformation. Now, to speak about Luther's attitude toward it. As the peasant uprising began to get underway and they issued manifestos attacking abuses, many of which were very real injustices and should have been remedied, and the better people among the Lord would undoubtedly have remedies if they had been fully aware of them, Luther saw the right of these claims, and yet he saw the extreme nature of some of the peasants' demands. But he wrote a publication to try to quiet down the disturbance. And in this publication, he pointed out the rightness of some of the peasants' demands and urged the Lord to follow them, grant them, but he also did urge that there be no uprising or turmoil, that all things be done decently and in order. But that was an incidental part of what he wrote. The main thing that he did was to urge the Lord to remedy these abuses. And Mincer and others took those parts of what Luther wrote and quoted them everywhere and said little about the other parts. And this led the peasants to think that Luther was their champion and was standing with them. And then when Mincer got great groups of the peasants into forming marauding bands that attacked castles and burned them down and killed the men and mistreated the women and did such unnecessary and useless destruction, then Luther wrote against the wickedness of the peasants. And he wrote a very strong writing now, saying that it was utterly wrong for people to take things in their own hands and start fighting and destroying like this, that powers to establish law and order were established of God, and that it was wrong to indulge in riots and fighting and destruction, and calling on the forces of law and order to use the strongest method to destroy the ringleaders and to quiet the people and to establish the law and order. And then, of course, some of the lords took this part of his writing and said, Luther is on our side. He wants these peasants to be utterly destroyed and eradicated. And some of social leaders among the peasants who felt that the kingdom of God can be established on earth by making an entirely new society and killing off all the oppressors, they said, Luther, whom we thought was with us, is actually a supporter of the state status quo and the powers that be. And some of them who had previously followed him turned against him. And it is often said he lost support there, but whether he lost any real support, he lost people really interested in what he really stood for, may be questioned. But he did, in this writing, use very, very strong language against the murdering, thieving gangs of peasants, something like that was the title of it. And he used very, very strong language, and the lords put down the peasants, and then some of the lords, in fact, the majority of them probably, but not men like John of Saxony or Philip of Hesse, proceeded to deal ruthlessly and cruelly with the ringleaders and their families and friends and with others who were suspected of having been connected with the revolt. And so Luther now wrote a writing addressed to the lords in which he urged them to not use this cruelty toward the defeated peasants and criticize them for the way that they were treating the defeated peasants. And so his three writings on this really are consistent. He urged everyone to follow justice and righteousness and kindness in their dealings with others, but he was opposed to violence, to bloodshed,
to this sort of procedure. He felt that God had given the emperor and the established powers the sword for the preservation of law and order, and they should use it to the extent that it was necessary, but should not go beyond what was necessary in that regard. And so he was perfectly consistent, actually, but each time he struck out at an abuse, he did it in very, very strong language. And this would lead people who wanted to attack him from either side can take the language that he used when he was attacking abuses on that side to show that actually he didn't belong with them. He really, they would say, was bad. However, the Reformation probably in the end was better off for the fact that Luther made clear that his movement was a spiritual movement and that he was urging all people to try to follow righteousness and peace and not advocating in any sense a change in the details of society or the establishment of a new social order. But this, as I say, has probably brought as much criticism to Luther as anything else in his whole life. Now that was G, the present war. Now H, Luther's marriage. Luther's marriage. And number one, his attitude. Luther's attitude was celibacy and forced celibacy is wrong. There is no biblical warrant for it. It makes an unnatural life and is not God's command in the first place. And those who serve the Lord are not required to be celibate. In fact, the normal thing is marriage. And therefore, he urged his friends to marry, and he tried to find wives, a husband for the nuns who had escaped and could not go home to their families. But he himself said, I don't think my life is going to last very long. I don't know how soon I will be seized and burned, and therefore it would be foolish for me to think of marriage. And so it was made quite plain to everyone he had no expectation of being married. His father, who had been very much upset when he went into the monastery in the first place, because he wanted him to become a great man, a great powerful man in Germany, his father often wrote him and said, you ought to marry. I'd like to have some grandchildren. Why don't you marry him? But his father, while he was a hard worker and probably a good man, didn't really understand what Martin was doing. And Martin always wrote his father and said, I don't expect to live very long. It'd be silly for me to marry. Number two, Catherine von Bora. Catherine von Bora, B-O-R-A. Now, this woman was an orphan who had entered the convent at an early age. She knew a little Latin, and she had what would be a moderate education for those days. She lived in the convent. Gertschmidt says, in ordinary times, she would have spent her life there and died without ever being heard of. But the Luther's teachings were read by the nuns in this convent, and many of them left, and we've noticed how she and the sister of Salzburg and certain others came to Wittenberg. And Luther managed to find husbands for all of them but Catherine von Bora. He found there was a young man whom she became very much in love with, and she thought that he was going to marry her, but evidently she had misinterpreted his words. He went away and she didn't hear from him. Luther tried to comfort her. And then she got they got word that he had married a rich girl in the area to which he had gone. And she still continued there in Wittenberg, and Luther suggested one or two people for her to marry, but she didn't care for them. She said, well, the only person I feel out here I'd care to marry is Luther himself. And number three, his sudden marriage. Suddenly, in the spring of 1525, Luther married. Somebody said, what'd you do that for? Well, he said, I did it to spite the devil, to vex the Pope, and to please my father. And people were surprised there was not much announcement of it ahead of time, and if they had a big, they had a private wedding ceremony when they were married. 2 weeks later, they had a public festivity to which all friends were invited, and they lived together for another 20 years before he died. And some of his letters to his wife are among the most beautiful letters I think that have ever been written. Often he would address her as Empress Kate. And he had all sorts of whimsical ways of addressing her and speaking of her. And she made him a good wife, a good homemaker. And in fact, their home became a specimen of what a true Christian home should be, and did much to advance the Reformation. One time when things seemed to be at their very worst, Luther became deeply despondent, and he was just cast in utter gloom, thinking everything was going bad. And one morning, they say, Catherine came in to breakfast, and she was all dressed in black. And Luther said, well, what's the matter? What's she dressed in black for? She says, who's died? Well, she says, God's dead. He says, God's dead? What blasphemy, what you're talking about? Well, she said, the way you go around moping here, seeing me, God must be dead. Why would you go this way? Well, he saw the point and immediately brightened up and snapped out. And they had a happy life together. Luther even wrote little cradle songs for his children, one of which, what is it, Away in the Cradle? No. Away in the Manger. Song for his head. I forget the words. Some people claim Luther didn't write that, but other hymn books have his name given as the author of it. And his letters home, speaking, and his letters to the children and to his wife, referring to the children, are, I think, among the most beautiful things of a type that ever have been written. But now we go on to J. Political events from 1525 to 1529. In September 1523, Pope Adrian VI died. And he was only pope for a year and a half. And during this time, he laid down what kind of life the cardinals should live, how they should, by the goodness of their lives, they should show forth the truth of the religion and the truth of their doctrines and so on. And the cardinals who were used to the happy, joyful life under Leo X didn't like it at all. And he did the same with wherever he found corruption. He spoke out against it, and he made rules that he couldn't enforce. He became pretty unpopular. And no non-Italian has ever been elected pope since. When he died, the next morning after he died, great wreaths of as if honoring a man were found placed in front of the door of his position. And rumor spread that he had been poisoned. There's no proof, so one way or the other, it's probably not the case. But it shows the attitude of the Romans toward Pope Adrian VI, who was very sincere in standing for what he thought was right. But his belief was founded upon the traditions and the superstitions of the Middle Ages rather than upon the Bible. Yes? It was September 1523 when he died. 1523. He died then, so I was going to call number one under these political events, accession of Clement VII. When he died, they decided they'd have enough popes of this type. And so they elected a man pope who was the cousin of Pius of Leo X. Leo X was the Medici. There have been two Medici popes. That is, Medici was a family in Florence, a wealthy family that ruled the city of Florence. Leo X was one of them. His secretary had been his first cousin. And Clement VII had all of Leo X's vices with none of his virtues. He was not a man like Alexander VI, the Borgia pope, or like Julius II. He was not an outstanding monster like a very few of the popes had been. He was just an average man interested in his own pleasure
and above all, in the advancement of his own family. And so during the dozen or so years that Clement VII was pope, he wanted the Lutheran revolt destroyed, and he was glad to give support to those who worked against it. But to him it was not a major thing, Paul. The major thing was the advancement of the Medici family. And so he had a cousin, a young girl, who he wanted to try to get married into one of the royal families. And he tried one royal family after another. And finally, he persuaded the King of France to marry her to his second son. And she came, the Pope went up to Paris for the wedding, and he was so happy he just couldn't contain himself. When she married actually into the royal family of France, his niece of his did, and she married the second son of the King of France. And he was just the descriptions of the Pope's joy there. It was the happiest moment in his whole life when this happened to advance his family. And this girl, later on, probably did more to hurt Protestantism, probably a dozen times as much as the Pope himself ever succeeded in doing in his life. We will speak of her a number of times later on. She was called Catherine de' Medici. But that enters into the later period in our history. She had a tough time with it. She married the second son of the King of France. Everybody considered her as a foreigner, and she was generally looked down on in France, and her husband didn't care for her. He'd only married her because it was the thing to do, that his father wanted to get the Pope's favor and marry him to her. He paid little attention to her. The father died, and the oldest son died before the father. So her husband became king, and when he became king, he had a mistress who lived with him and was given all honor, and Catherine was utterly ignored. But then he died in a tournament after a few years, and then her young son, who was not yet 20, became king, and she was the real power. And she had three sons who ruled, and she really ruled. And she pretty well ruined France, but she did a tremendous lot to her the Reformation. But I just tell that for interest. Now we'll look into it later where it comes when we look at France during those later years. But now this was Clement VII, who was Pope for a dozen years. And this is another reason why the Reformation was able to get well underway. If there had been a Pope now, like the Popes of 20 or 30 years later, who were determined to crush the Reformation, it was not yet too late to do it. It could have been done in these next few years either. Number two, the emperor's troubles. The emperor's troubles. Leo X hadn't wanted the emperor to be emperor, and neither did Clement VII. In fact, Clement VII, when he married his niece to the second son of the King of France, his interest was with France rather than with the emperor. And the fighting largely was done as it had been done before in Italy. And in Italy, the emperor's force came to consist in Italy partly about half of Spaniards and about half of Germans, and most of the Germans were followers of Luther. And this force, which was in Italy, the emperor was up in Spain and in the Netherlands. He had his generals directing it. He actually didn't do much directing the army himself until after 1530. He was very active in it after that time. But in these years, when he wasn't in Italy, he was one time did not send enough money to pay the troops. And the troops went some time without any pay, and they were getting restive and not having enough to eat. And the army was quartered just outside of Rome. He was trying to bring pressure on the Pope to take a more friendly attitude toward him, but had no thought of hurting the Pope because he was determined to support the one Catholic Church as he believed in it. And the army simply took things in its own hands and attacked Rome and took the city. And Clement VII fled to a fortress within the city called the Mausoleum of Hadrian. And he was there for several months while the troops of Charles V ran riots in Rome
plunder and seizing anything they wanted.
The sack of Rome, it had not occurred to Rome for nearly 1,000 years, such a disaster as came to Rome now. And right during that time, when the Pope was a prisoner there, he got a letter from Henry VIII of England asking him to give Henry the right to divorce his wife. But the Pope didn't dare do it, because the wife Henry wanted to divorce was the aunt of the Emperor, Charles V. And with the Pope in a situation like that, he couldn't very well do it. And that affected the future of the Reformation in England very definitely. But we look at that when we come to England. Now, much more important for Germany than this is number three, the two Diets of Spires. The two Diets of Spires. The first of these was in 1526. Now, there was a diet every year, but the emperor didn't get to any diet from 1521 until 1530. Yes? Yes, that was number two. I spoke about the sack of Rome under it. Number three is the two Diets of Spires.
Oh, then that was the trouble of the sack.
No, the sack of Rome was just typical of the trouble. Yes. The Diets of Spires. Now, the word the spires is usually anglicized into S-P-I-R-E-S. The spelling was not made definite in those days as it is today. Things were more or less in a state of flux. So, in fact, they remained so until the typewriter was invented. This is what made us stick to our utterly antiquated system that we are using today. But they had a diet every year, but none of them are of great importance politically until 1530, because the emperor was not present. But some of them are of comparatively little importance, others are somewhat greater. And these two, politically, were of intermediate importance, but religiously of tremendously great importance, 1526 and 1529. Now, in 1526, the nobles met at Spires, and George wanted that they should utterly wipe out the Reformation, George II. But others said, no, we believe in him. And still others said, no, we think the Reformation is wrong, but we also think the Pope is wrong. He said, the church is filled with corruption. The Medici popes are interested in their own welfare and that of their families, not in any spiritual thing. Let the church reform before we begin to try anything against Luther. And when they couldn't agree, in 1526, the Diet passed an action that they called the Recess of Spires. That was that every lord should so act in religious matters as he could answer to God and to the emperor. In other words, it was up to the individual lord. And the Romanist lords like George took this as evidence that they were backed up in trying to utterly destroy Protestantism within their area. But the Protestant lords, like John and Philip, took this as saying, we do what we consider right before God, and we believe Luther's teaching is right, and that's what's going to be preached in our territory. So it established a system in which each lord determined what would be the religion of his area. And the next 2 years, the diets didn't amount to much, so there was really nothing more vital done until 1529, when there was another diet at the same place, at Spires, in which the Romanist nobles were in a majority. And the brother of the emperor, his brother Ferdinand, a rather hot-headed fellow, who was strongly opposing Luther, was demanding that they do something definite against Luther, and they proceeded to pass an action declaring that the Edict of Worms that declared Luther to be an outlaw and no one was to be allowed to support him was still in force and should be supported throughout the empire. And when the majority passed this action in 1529, the others who were following the action of 1526, which they said gave them the right to have Protestant, to have Bible teaching in their areas. They said that one diet could not thus annul the action of another diet. And so they issued a protest. And all the people who supported this protest came to be called Protestants. And so if they call you a Protestant, properly speaking, that means somebody who protests against the action of the second diet of Spire. Which, of course, is very silly, because today the word Protestant has been entirely divorced from its original meaning and means something entirely different, though it refers to the same individual. But that's where our word Protestant comes from. The protest that was made against the action of the Diet of 1529 in seeking to annul the action of 1526. That is where our word protest comes from. And it wouldn't be so tremendously important if it were not for the Diet of 1529, if it weren't for two reasons, one of which is that our word Protestant comes from it. And another reason is that the action of the Roman nobles at this diet in early 1529 led some of the Protestant nobles to say, it is up to us to get together and stand together, or we are going to be destroyed individually. And so after this, then the story go back to the Romans, and they say, well, we got to stand together in order that our part shall be something, and went back and forth. And so it began to crystallize the rulers into two different groups, between which eventually it looked as if war would break up. But the negotiations in endeavoring to gather them together into two groups this way became a very important development in the political sphere. And Philip of Hesse was one who was particularly aware of this. And Philip, even before this, had been trying to get the Protestant leaders to stand together and to prepare so that if they were attacked, they would be ready to defend themselves. And some of the Protestant rulers were very glad to do it, but most of them had such a tremendous regard for Luther that they felt that, is this a right thing to do? If Luther will say, it is all right, but we're not going to take a step without Luther's approval. And they asked Luther, and Luther said no. Luther said, the emperor is the ruler, and we must obey the emperor. We must stand for the word of God. We must do what the word of God says. But, he said, if the emperor, to whom God has given the power, if the emperor opposes us, and if he kills us, we must die. He said, we have no right to resist the emperor. And then the Lord came to Luther, and they said, yes, but Luther, they said, we are lords of certain areas for generations. Our ancestors have ruled these areas. We have power that belongs to us. Is not this power equally established of God? Now, they said, should not we fight to defend the power that belongs to us? And Luther said, well, he said, that is different. He said, yes, if the emperor attacks the power that properly belongs to you, then under certain circumstances, you have the right to defend yourself. But he says, you have no right to try to make changes by force of arms. And so when Luther took this attitude, then Philip wanted to get all those who stood together for the biblical teaching to make an agreement to defend one another. And now the difficulty came because some of them, Luther didn't feel, were really at one with him. And so there was a very famous meeting in Zwingli's territory, a meeting which resulted in dividing Protestantism eventually into two different groups. But we're not quite ready for that. Before we take that up, we want to look at something else that happened at this same period, capital K, Luther and Erasmus. Luther and Erasmus. Number one, Erasmus' early attitude. have already mentioned to you, how Erasmus was influenced by John Colet, who in turn has been influenced by Pico della Mirandola in Florence. And John Colet got Erasmus interested in the Bible. Even before that, Erasmus had been attacking the folly of the Pope. He wrote the work on Julius excluded from heaven right after Julius' death. At least it's universally believed that he wrote it. And he wrote his book in praise of folly, which has been reprinted many, many times, even in recent years, in which he criticizes the frivolities and the selfishness of popes, archbishops, and leaders of every kind. And when they first asked Erasmus, "Do you think Luther has done injury?" And he says, "He's done something that's injurious." When Luther first came out with his thesis, Erasmus said, "Certainly, Luther has." He says, "He's injured the Pope as to his crown and the monks as to their belt." And that was the statement Erasmus made, which naturally led the people who favored Luther, who inclined toward him, to incline still further toward him. There are those today who say, if only it had been Erasmus instead of Luther, we would have had evolution instead of revolution. But actually, Erasmus was one who was always glad to stand for truth so long as it wouldn't in any way hurt him. But if he stood to lose anything, then he would try to back water. And so he was always trying to avoid personally being injured. I read you the account of Erasmus' visit with Colet to the Canterbury in England. And Erasmus issued that using false names, so you can't be sure it's Erasmus or Colet, but it seems almost certain it was, and showing, really making fun of the worship of relics and the other superstitions. His edition of the Greek New Testament had a great influence. And in fact, the last few verses of the Greek New Testament until recently were reprinted in every Bible. They were written by Erasmus and weren't found in any Bible manuscript anywhere. That was because the publisher was in such a hurry to get it out, and they couldn't find a manuscript that had those verses in. So finally, Erasmus made his own translation of them back from the Latin. And that's been part of our Textus Receptus until quite recently. And then now, of course, are replaced by verses we find in verse. You had a question? Yes? They were saying that about Erasmus, and Erasmus didn't want anybody to think he had anything to do with something that might come under displeasure and might cut down his income to some extent. And so people were asking Erasmus to write against Luther, and finally, in September 24th, he did so. And we'll look at that next week.